back here and switch it back in the back. David, can you talk about switch it back in the back?
Pardon me?
Center back.
Center back.
Can you talk about what's the most successful thing that you've done for you? Was it producing Broadway plays or producing movies, and why?
I had successes with music, movies, and Broadway shows. I couldn't tell you what I think is the most successful.
I think they all were.
Mr. Gavitt, way in the back here, just a little bit to the left of where you were looking before. Success is a wonderful tool, but are you more motivated by the successes that you've had or the failures that you've incurred?
Well, I always think that failure is a great motivator for future successes, but there is no success without failure.
What was the touchstone for you? Why were you driven?
Meet my mother.
Batya.
Question in the center, Mr. Gavitt. I'm from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Are you interested in buying our paper?
I'm sorry.
I'm from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. I know that you'd like to own a newspaper and do a job.
I tried to buy one and failed.
Can you talk about what the inspiration was for that? Are you still looking at buying the LA Times?
I tried to buy the New York Times. I actually didn't try to buy the LA Times. I tried to look at the books of the LA Times.
Okay. And do you have any interest in owning a newspaper now?
No.
I guess you're not going to buy a newspaper.
No.
Mr. Gavitt?
If I'm there, I'll buy.
I did see the film, by the way. It was great. And I'm with the Jewish Journal. So I wanted to ask you a little bit, if you could tell us a little bit about your Jewish background, whether it's cultural, secular, or religious, and how that, as well as the influence of your parents, if at all, has contributed, influenced your commitment to philanthropy.
My mother came to America from Palestine in 1931. My father met her in Palestine. And they were socialists, really. And we didn't have, I was born in Israel, but we didn't have much of a religious life at all. Does that not answer your question?
At all, or
for
the religion, or your parents?
Well, I would think that everybody's childhood is an influence on what happens in their future, don't you think? Me too. Pardon me? My parents were poor, they weren't into philanthropy.
You know, one of the stories I wasn't able to tell in the film, because it was just a limit, is what happened, and I don't know whether you
know, I'm sorry.
There is a
hi. She wanted me to talk about how my mother's family was killed, you know. That's not.
By the Nazis.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on the music business today. What do you think some of the challenges would be for if you were starting out as a music producer or an executive today?
I'd kill myself. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, all my peers wanted to play guitar and be in a band. Today, I think if you're growing up today, I think you're not as focused on the music business as you are and trying to be a programmer. You know, I mean, that's where success seems to lie so publicly.
Well,
just
Mr. Gavitt, I know that you're no longer, my name is Dominic Patton from Deadline Hollywood. You're no longer so involved in the day-to-day activity of DreamWorks, but
I'm not involved in DreamWorks at all.
What is your opinion about the day-to-day, about the movie industry?
It's 4 o'clock.
Well, the demise of the DVD is has a huge impact on the movie business and the financial model of how you make money in the movie business, and it's changed everything.
Changes for documentaries, too.
So, to follow up on a question earlier, would you get into the movie business today?
You mean if I was starting out?
Yeah.
It's very hard to get in the movie business then and now. You know, I think it's a very tough bullseye to hit. To get a job in the entertainment business is difficult. To Succeeding in the entertainment business, I think, is difficult, and I found it difficult personally.
Let me ask you a question, David. You tell the story in the film of how you put $2 billion together in a week for DreamWorks. And Steven Spielberg talks about how David had said the reason that most studios have failed, new studios in their attempt to create a new studio fails, so they were underfunded. And David said we have to overfund DreamWorks. So there were $1.8 billion in before it started turning profit. Would you be able to put that together now?
Oh, impossible. No, it's not possible.
I think there's the answer to your question.
I think there is.
Brandon Burton, slightly to your right on the mezzanine, right here. To your right. I have two questions. First, as Mr. Brady called you, gifted, you know, diplomatic, were you fearless in hearing from some of these people in putting the film together? And some of the people that perhaps had some issues with how you had dealt with them?
I'm sorry, can you just say that again?
Sure. Or I was curious if you were fearless in your approach to some of these interviews that done with people like Glenn Frey and, you know, some people.
I have nothing to do with that. I have no impact on this film whatsoever.
But you narrated, so there must have been.
No, it doesn't narrate.
No, I don't narrate.
I used David's interview to basically move the story along. It's not narrated.
Okay. Well, then
and I had absolutely no input in this film or in anybody that they, you know, that they interviewed or gave them a list of people to interview.
I was the one that was fearless.
And then, so as a follow-up, having seen it, did you find that you learned anything about yourself during this process making the film?
Well, you know, you watch yourself get old and bald. It's a sobering experience.
David, usually straight back here, straight this way.
Oh, okay.
Over here, yeah. Usually, it seems to be it's a transformative experience if someone comes across like a possibly fatal disease and so forth. And you've had it happen twice in your life because you had the misdiagnosis of cancer, and later when you finally got tested for HIV, you found out you didn't have HIV.
That's right.
Okay. In those two cases, it must give you a chance to rethink your life or where you're going.
Well, after the misdiagnosis of cancer, I just stopped working, and I thought, here I am. I've been working all my life and made all this money and didn't have any fun, really. Didn't get high. I thought, I'm going to get high and get laid. The HIV thing is an entirely different issue. I mean, you know, people were dropping like flies in the early 80s. And if you were gay, you had no idea whether you had it or not. You know, it was a very, very scary period of time. And it sort of blossomed at the beginning of the 80s. And so I took my eye off the ball of get the records completely. I thought I'm going to die. I might as well do something other than finding recording scars. And then when I had the test and I found out that I was HIV negative, I thought, oh, I have really not paid attention to my record company. I better get my act together.
And
I did.
Now, during the times when you weren't working for different reasons, did you find out that you really were happiest when you were working a lot?
I like working. I've always worked. I've always enjoyed it.
Mr.
I always thought it was fun to get to the office.
To your left.
Question? Mr. Geffen, I've always wondered, since I was a big fan of Laura Nyro.
To your left.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was a big fan of Laura Nyro. Why she didn't get to the next level in public acceptance?
Well, you know, I have my own opinion about that. When she decided not to go to Asylum Records, we were no longer together and she never had another success.
let me ask
you about the time that you got Bob Dylan on your label. It was the only time he was never on Columbia. That must have been a very difficult thing to get him on.
We had become friends, and I had put the band and Bob Dylan back together again, put them on the road, and it was very exciting for me. I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan.
But it didn't last too long. Why? Was there only one thing?
Because, for one thing, that was 1974, I believe, and 5. And I left the music business to go to Warner Brothers Pictures at that time.
Did you lose interest in music at some
point? No, I never lost interest in music. I originally wanted to be in the movie business, and as I say in this film, Jerry Brandt was the head of the rock and roll department, they called it then, at the Lee Marks Agency, and he said to me, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be in the movie business. He said, really? He says, you think Norman Jewison is going to sign with you? I was 21, you know. He said, if I were you, I'd go in the music business. Mick Jagger was 21. And everybody returns my phone calls. He was Mick Jagger's agent. So I thought, oh, well, maybe my eyes on the wrong wall.
But you really picked up on a whole sound, a whole group of singer-songwriters.
That was 1968 through, let's say, 1973. We're talking now about 1964. Okay. You know, it's when I was starting with Morse Agency.
Well, let's talk about that time. You were picking up on this kind of California sound that other people weren't. What did people not hear in Jackson Browne that you did?
That I couldn't possibly tell you. I heard his songs and thought, wow, this guy's really great. Other people didn't hear it. I passed on things. I tell a story about when I was at the Lee Marks Agency, Wally Amos, famous cookies, was a music agent, and he represented Simon and Garfunkel. And nobody at the Lee Marks Agency had any interest in Simon and Garfunkel. Anyway, Wally asked me to go with him to Gertie's Folk City. And we went to Gertie's Folk City, and it was Paul and Artie with one guitar. They did their set. And we go backstage, and Artie Garfunkel pulls me aside, because you have your little card, and says, David, get from the Lee Marks Agency. And he said to me, what do you think? He says, I'm in architecture school. Do you think I should stay in school, or should I give it up and go into show business? I said, stay in school.
Hey, I never knew that story. But you know, I don't know if you watched the film, you know that David, of course, was an early champion of Joni Mitchell and also orchestrated the putting together Crosby, Stills, and Nash, who were all on different labels and wanted to form a band and needed somebody to help them get them all off their different labels and onto, so they could be a band, and David did that. And put the Eagles together, too.
Mr. Geffen, you said you're absolutely not involved in DreamWorks. Does that mean you've not seen Lincoln? You get to tell part
of
it?
I have not seen Lincoln. I hear it's wonderful.
Do you have any idea how long it is?
I have no idea.
David sold his interest in DreamWorks many years ago, so he's not involved at all, really. Well, you did the Oracle?
I'm not involved in DreamWorks, but I still own, four or five million shares of DreamWorks Animation. I actually don't own myself. I don't own my foundation.
Mr. Geffen, right here.
Okay.
Susan has told us how fresh shiny you are. Why did you do this film, and Susan? How did you convince him to do it?
She didn't have to convince me. She called me up and said she wanted to do the film, and I said to her, "You want to do a film?" I'm like, "Yeah, I don't think I fit into this category." She thought I did, and I was flattered. You know, I watched American Masters. I think the show is fantastic. I thought the film on Jerome Robbins and Leonard Bernstein, so many of these are just incredibly compelling and inspiring for people. And they certainly were for me. I saw Jerome Robbins' film 10 times. So when she called up and said she wanted to do one on me, I was flattered. That's one.
It was harder to get David to agree to come here today.
Back up to your right,
okay.
There were people you were passed on, but has anyone ever said no to David Geffen?
Oh,
an
sure.
Artist that you pursued that you
passed
on?
Yes, of course. Many.
Who was the one you wanted the most that said no?
Who was the one I wanted the most that said no? There were many. You know, I wanted R.E.M. They went with Warner Brothers. I can't think of ones, but it's not about the ones that say no, it's about the ones that say yes. You know, your life isn't made up of the people who
aren't in it. David, right over here. Of all the artists that you have, like Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Joni Mitchell, and everyone sell those up there. Who is your favorite? I mean, if you could pick one of those acts.
I'm a big fan of Joni Mitchell's and Bob Dylan, and so many of these artists. You know, I don't have a favorite. You know, it's like saying, what's your favorite film? You know, there's certainly 10 of your favorite films. I would not have picked one.
Is it one that you have a special story about or a special memory?
I have special memories about all of them.
David and Joni Mitchell were roommates for a while.
Yep.
Actually, which is a very interesting story.
Mr. Gaffin, back here, center a little bit to your right. Yeah.
You didn't really answer the question of why you had been interested in owning a newspaper, and I was curious also just as...
Okay, I was interested.
As an investor, just how you see the newspaper industry.
I was not looking to be a newspaper owner as an investment. I was going to buy the New York Times out of my foundation and make it a nonprofit. Because I think the New York Times is essential.
And what do you think since then? I mean, since that was floated, a number of other billionaires have actually bought newspapers. How do you feel about that trend?
I hope they make a lot of money. What can I tell you? I have no feeling about what other people do.
But it was your impetus to do it, as I understand it, and I'll put words in your mouth, is that you were concerned about the future of the press in America if it were a totally marketplace-driven situation and you want to protect freedom of journalism.
I think that it's very hard to survive as a regional or local newspaper today. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are national newspapers, and so they have an entirely different profit structure. And friends of mine who work for the New York Times are constantly telling me how much they're cutting budgets and everything. And I thought I could do something that would be worthwhile and keep the New York Times as strong as possible. I think the New York Times is a very important newspaper.
Down here, you have a long involvement in music, and with all the television shows about, you know, getting new artists out there, are you thinking, or would you think of doing anything like that, or do you have any other ideas for doing something new in the music industry?
I have no ideas.
Back here. Mr. Geffen, over here.
Okay.
A few years ago, Carly Simon outed you as the person.
No, that's simply not true.
Okay. That's what I'm
saying. I'm not vain, but I'm not her vain.
What did you think? What did you think when you heard the story that you were the subject of that story?
Well, I thought the same thing about it as when I heard the story that I married Keanu Reeves, who I'd never met. You know, you're a journalist. You know about this.
What about when Joni said you were the subject of Free Man in Paris?
Yes, she did.
She didn't write that about me.
One out of three. That's good journalism.
But Carly Simon's song was supposedly about a lot of different people. Warren Beatty, Mick Jagger. I think you were one. You were in good company.
You mentioned being a viewer of American Masters. Now, when you determined that you wanted to be a part of this and you wanted to, at least to some degree, vocalize your own story, did you have a sense of the way you wanted your story to
play? I had no input in this, honestly. I wasn't asked to give her any input, and I had no input.
Well, no, I'm not asking about the final copy of this. I'm talking about, you know, when you sit down and you tell stories to a camera.
I'm asked a question, and I'm answering those questions. I had nothing to do with the makeup of those questions. I was just there to answer her questions.
But you still decide how you want to tell the stories.
Well, I try to tell the story as accurately as I can.
Okay, so accuracy was paramount.
Yeah, well, I tried to tell them with a sense of humor about it.
It's true of all of our films. We do a lot of interviews. I did 4 extensive interviews with David. I'm pretty sure I did not want to use narration because there was such an incredibly interesting cast of characters, from Tom Hanks to Steven Spielberg to, you know, David Crosby. David was one of those. So the decision not to have a narrator was my decision. And I was very happy with the interviews that David gave. But David, I asked the questions, and David gave the answers. I decided I would tell the story.
I still understand that, but still, everyone has a perspective on their own life and a perspective of what they want to put forward to the world.
I really had no idea what this was going to be. As I told you, I did not think that I was a great candidate for this, but Susan didn't, you know, you decide for yourself when you see the film. I was happy with it.
Over on your left here, in the mezzanine, hi, David. So, what's happening in Sardinia? That's not my question, but I'm curious.
My boat is there.
I want to ask you, you seem to have a wickedly dry sense of humor that seems that gets you through rough times in life, the roller coaster that life is. Can you look back and think of something that you're proud of with your professional accomplishments, and what are you proudest of with your personal accomplishments?
Well, I'm proud of all the things I've done. I think that it was fun to do. I look back on it, particularly seeing this film, and I think, wow, you did that, all that. You know, I don't tend to think about the past. I think about what I'm doing now. I really don't reflect on my career, or I don't like to talk about myself. I avoid it as much as possible. And when I saw the film, I thought, wow, I was impressed.
So was I. But, okay, then what gets you up in the morning now? What gets you excited that you're involved
in? I'm excited every day.
About what?
Whatever I'm going to do.
What are you going to do?
I find life incredibly interesting and compelling, and I like talking to interesting people. I like reading great books. I can read, you know, 4 or 5 books a week, not say a word and be thrilled to death. I don't carry a cell phone. I never have. I've never texted anybody in my life. I've never had an ATM machine.
You have an ATM machine?
I don't know what it is.
Your personal ATM machine. I can tell you what a lot of people told me, which didn't make it into the film because there's just a limit on what you put into a film. And this is really about the work, but many of David's friends think one of the things he's proudest of is our friendships, which are extremely strong and have survived decades. And there's a real loyalty that David both has to his friends and his friends have to him. And another thing I learned is from David, and I know this from my phone calls, that David's up about 5:30 in the morning and he's read every newspaper before everybody else has had coffee and knows everything that's going on and wants to talk about it at great length with his friends. So David still maintains a very active life.
Was that your key to success? Being the smartest man in the room?
You know, I never thought I was the smartest man in the room, I have to tell you, but when I finally got to the William Morris Agency, I really did very poorly in school. I thought I was dumb, and I think other people thought I was dumb too. And I'd had any number of jobs that I was fired from high school until I got to the William Morris Agency. And when I got to the William Morris Agency and I'm delivering the mail, I have to wait in these offices and I hear these agents on the phone and I thought, they bullshit on the phone. I can do that.
Even further on the left here at the back. Just wait a minute.
Okay.
Susan, during this process, was there something that stands up to you that surprised you or you found unexpected about David, and then if David could respond to that, assuming there is something?
Well, I didn't know David at all, so one of the things I was pleasantly surprised for that is how funny David is and how much fun it was to be with him. In terms of the story, I really knew, I grew up on Asylum and those artists. And Laura Nero, who's not on the sideline, but someone I love this music, which is what had brought me and David to my attention to begin with, who can't imagine the 70s without Asylum Records, and thought that was an incredible achievement. And then to learn when I met David, because I didn't really have been boned up all that terribly much, that his taste and his reach was so vast, and every single thing that he was involved with was the best of what it was, and that really, really was interesting to me. He didn't just do Broadway shows, he did the best Broadway shows. He
the longest running, the most, you know, interesting ones. Of course, DreamWorks is an astounding achievement. But then David has been, I mean, honestly, the person you see here is the person he is, very modest, and doesn't toot his own horn very much. I want to toot it for him.
Is that valid, David?
But then I'm modest. You know, in the eyes of the beholder.
Thank you.
Hello, David. I was just curious if you ever in your past have come across an album of astrology songs.
Astrology songs?
Yes.
No.
Thank you. Why do you ask that?
I wrote the album. I wrote the songs. It's a song for each sign of the zodiac. It's on YouTube. You can go to the astrology song. And I see a little clip of your sign. And the reason I asked it is because I'm just curious how much penetration I've gotten with it.
Excuse me. We're back to the press conference. Susan.
Where are you?
Sorry.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
A little while ago, he was telling a story, and I apologize for not remembering exactly what it was, but he looked surprised, like there was something he said that you didn't actually know.
I didn't know that.
You're going to make him go back?
No. I didn't know that David had had an opportunity to you know, that he told our Garfunkel State Architecture
School. Oh, right. Okay.
That they were not going to have a career.
You don't have time to go back and put that in?
No. I don't. This film is finished.
David, two things. First of all, when we talk about DreamWorks, as Susan said, it being an astounding success, was it a complete success? Or I was thinking the music part of it didn't work and you had to sell that off?
Well, you know, the music business was in decline by the time, you know, Mo got it up and going. Was it a success? We sold the Simon Records to Universal for $100 million. I would say that's some kind of success.
Okay. And the other thing I was going to ask you is, Susan said it's a wonderful story about why you and Joni Mitchell were living together for a while. Tell us that.
That story I can't tell you. I mean, it's personal.
Okay. Then let me ask one other thing instead. The part in the film where the guy wouldn't give you the $5 million advance, so
He was the chairman.
And so ultimately, it was a mistake that cost him maybe $350 million.
It cost him, $375 million.
How much satisfaction did you get out of that
whole thing? Well, let me say, it's always nice to think about the $375 million, but at the time that went down, which was 1984, as I said, there was the AIDS crisis. I did not really focus on my record company. Friends of mine were dying left and right. And when the test became available so that you could find out whether you were negative or positive, I think it was around 84, 85. I think that Steve Ross, who was a good friend of mine, no longer believed that Geffen Records was going to be successful. And he didn't want to really invest much in the company. And I hadn't lost faith in it. And so I made a deal with him in which I said I would take no money for the next 5 years. And at the end of the 10-year total, that I would end up with his half. And I think he thought that half was not going to be valuable. I don't think he thought it was going to succeed. And I think that that opinion was shared by many people. And from the time we made that deal, virtually 6 months later, everything we put out was a hit. I mean, the company just, you know, exploded.
I'm sure that Steve Ross had a lot of regrets about it.
He was very upset about it. He was.
But you know, I want to make a point about DreamWorks. DreamWorks was also not immediately successful.
It's not possible to do that.
Exactly. David understood
that. It takes time to build an infrastructure. It takes time to assemble the people, and the development has to grow and, you know, nurture itself. It's, It's a very hard thing to start a company from scratch.
Mr. Gethin? About the demise of DVDs, which you talked about earlier, can you attribute any of that to the lack of movie stars that we have today?
No, I don't think that's the reason at all. I think the reason is you know, the experience of the consumer is that they buy a DVD and they watch it once, and they probably never look at it again. That's probably most of your experience with it as well. Today, you can have it streamed to you. You only have to pay to see it once. It's a lot less than buying it. And it's always available if you want to see it a second time. So the business model has changed dramatically. And I don't think it's about stars. The biggest movies in the world today don't have stars in them. There are no stars in them. Avatar has no stars in them. Avengers, you know, other than the small part that Robert Downey had, that's not got big stars. I don't think that in the world today, the story means more today than the cast means today, I think. And that's a big change. It used to be that you could count on a movie doing a certain level of gross based on who was in it. It's simply not true anymore.
Is there any job in show business that you would love to take now if offered?
I'm 69, I don't have a job.
America doesn't.
Pardon me?
Mr. Gethin, here in the center, again, I'm sure you're still being pursued by political candidates for contributions. Are you still involved in that? And
I'm maxed out. I've hit the limits that are, and I have it every political year.
What do you say about the role of big money?
I think it's awful and damaging to the country.
What should be done?
Well, the Supreme Court made that decision. There's nothing anybody can do about it.
Claudine Muller-Demont, do you think that Joni Mitchell got the recognition that she deserves? And what is she doing? How is she doing?
She's gotten every honor that you can possibly get. So when you say whether she's gotten enough recognition, I don't know what more recognition she can get.
She doesn't think she has.
Joni... I interviewed her, and yes, I think so.
Pardon me?
I interviewed her, and she doesn't think that she...
Yes, it's true. She doesn't think...
I think so, too, compared to the people that she inspired.
Every award you can get, she got. There is no award you can possibly get, she hasn't got.
And every songwriter says that she's the best. I mean, David Crosby literally says, 100 years from now, she and Bob Dylan will be the only
one to remember. I think Joni Mitchell's a great artist, and I think it's unfortunate that she doesn't feel that she's recognized. I mean, it's simply not so.
Mr. Gethin, you talked earlier about if you didn't think it would be impossible for someone to raise the $1.8 billion you did with DreamWorks.
Today.
Why?
Well, because the business model has changed. You know, that's...
And specifically, investors would just not be willing to...
I don't think you could get a startup today and raise $2 billion. I just don't think you can do it. If someone can do it, God bless them, I mean, but I just don't think you can do it. I don't think I can do it.
Well, David did it in a week. Yes, that was surprised me. That was one of the biggest things that surprised me, that David could put $2 billion together in a week.
Mr. Gethin, in the front, if you could jump into Richard Branson's Time Machine and vault 20 years into the future, what do you think the entertainment industry will look like then, or is it even a foolhardy thing to think about?
No, I think the entertainment industry, you know, will be a vibrant industry in very different ways than we experience it today. People are going to want to sing, and people are going to want to watch movies, and they're going to want to watch plays. How they watch them and how it's delivered to their homes, or whether it's delivered to theaters, I think is going to change dramatically, but I don't think that the future of the entertainment business is going to be less important 20 years from now. I think there'll be industries that will be far more profitable.
And a quick follow-up, looking at the industry as it is today, is it easier or harder, do you think, for really bright, new, but undiscovered talent to be found?
Well, it's much harder in the music business because you don't have top 40 radio, you don't have MTV playing these videos, you know, a lot. One of the very few artists that's made it big in this period of time through the internet is Justin Bieber. You know, there aren't that many artists that have come to great, you know, stardom and recognition from the internet. But in the future, it may be different. I have no idea. You need repetition. You need to be able to hear things a lot.
And David, right over here again, to your left, right here in front.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Okay, you mentioned about the demise of DVDs. Okay, we can use it with the, like, Netflix and then streaming. What if you, like, have DVDs and you can't get them on Netflix and you want to maybe watch them, like, 10 years from now? And well, the other part for your answer is where you had, I guess, started with Tom Cruise's career. You said that there's not big stars to carry a movie, and Rock of Ages had such a build-up to it. But it actually bombed in the...
It was a bad movie. I thought. But, you know, it's unusual when a bad movie succeeds. You know, we're kind of shocked, aren't we?
Two-part question. What would the Netflix, if you wanted to watch...
In the future, you'll be able to access every movie ever made at any time. That'll be just a few years from now. Every movie ever made you can stream. Very short amount of time. Just like you can now access every piece of music.
So immediately. Now on the fact about bigger movie stars, that they're not pulling talent, the box office records. Even though Avatar was more, I mean, it was a good movie, but like Avengers made a fortune. And you had...
Only Robert Downey as a...
But you had Chris Hemsworth, too.
He's not still.
No, he is now.
Well, everybody's a star after their successes, aren't they? But he wasn't a success going into it.
One more question.
Oh, center, second level. Right here, second level.
Okay.
So you have Nirvana. That was one of your DGC bands. Do you ever think there'll be another band with that kind of cultural impact?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I think.
What will it take, because the music industry is so changed, people don't care about albums as much, especially young people?
It seems to me there's always been, Al Jolson was a huge star, and then it was Bing Crosby, and then it was Frank Sinatra, and then it was Elvis Presley, and then it was the Beatles. I mean, there's going to be somebody who captures the imagination of the country or the world. I think that's, we can bet on that. I don't know who it's going to be, but human nature.
Program. Can you tell me, you had answered bragging on David a moment ago about the friendship and the loyalty and all the wonderful people that we saw in the show, obviously good close friends of yours, but were there some that were not friends? Adversaries almost. But
they're in the film as well.
but who admire him so much that, they'll brag on him?
I'm sorry?
That they'll brag about you even though they're your adversaries.
Well, they're in the film. If you watch it, you'll see them.
And they're not so
much. The Eagles sued me twice. I got sued by the Eagles on Asylum Records and then Don Henley at Geffen Records.
And they're in the film talking about that.
Yeah,
so they're not exactly bragging, but...
But I've maintained a relationship pretty much with all of those people. I don't carry a grudge for very long.
Okay, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.